Ways and Means Chair. We don't quite have enough for a quorum yet to act on the minutes, but members, by way of introduction, Larissa Pulcola knows the humor of the first piece that I'll call your attention to, because this is not a bill we have before us this year, but it was one we had before us last year, and the local community put its case on paper, and I thought it was an absolutely wonderful way to introduce the subject that we're going to be educated about today, and it is titled, Why Would Anyone Care About the Richmond Wastewater Treatment Plant? Richmond is a small city stuck in central Minnesota in an area dotted with other small cities. Who cares about some smelly old treatment plant in a little town nobody has ever heard of? And then they give us some of the facts. The estimated cost of $8 million for a new treatment plant equals $6,225 for every man, woman, and child in the city. If the annual debt payments were charged through the water sewer bills, the average resident would be paying over $115 per month. With upwards of 40% of Richmond residents below or significantly below median family incomes, this is a financial burden. Then they point out where this is. Richmond sits on the edge of the Sauk River and the horseshoe chain of lakes with a sewage treatment plant that is 20 years older than its designed lifespan. Every day the current plant operates is a day we are playing dice with the health of a large and complex watershed system. And then they talk about the growth in the area and the potential jobs and opportunity. And if you turn to two pages later, there's an email from the MPCA, MPCA findings during their Richmond treatment plant visit. Cheryl and I did a drop-in visit to the Richmond water treatment plant because we were in the area. This was the first time I'd ever been to this facility, and frankly, I was shocked when I saw it. This place is a disaster waiting to happen. It is an old activated sludge plant, which is overloaded. Hoses were lying on the ground all over the place, running from tank to tank. Lots of crusty black foam on most of the tanks. Metal dividing walls were corroded and disintegrating. My first impression was that this plant had to be putting out a terrible effluent. But it looked great. In my estimation, these operators are performing miracles. This plant is literally held together with duct tape and baling wire. The city desperately needs a new plant. I don't know if there's anything worth salvaging there. The sticking point is, of course, money. They need financial help but are way down on the funding list. The operators are probably hurting their own cause by making this mess work so well. We need to do something to help them. If you look on the last page, you will, this isn't a great copy of it, but it shows that this treatment plant doesn't impact the immediate area. It also affects one of the most complex watersheds in the state, and St. Cloud gets its drinking water directly from this river downstream from Richmond. It is a story that one town told and serves as an introduction for the education we're going to receive today. And we have in your packet the Clean Water Legacy Act, and I think there are a couple of handouts in that particular part of your packet. And Terry Coleman is here, Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. We do now have a quorum. And Representative Genius, if you would move the minute.
I do.
Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries, and those minutes are adopted for Tuesday, February 15th. Mr. Coleman, welcome to the committee.
Pleasure to be here, Madam Chair. My name is Terry Coleman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority. In your packet, I'm going to be going through this book, trying to explain who we are, what we do, how we do it a little bit, and then provide some information as far as the needs and that are out there. A couple members, I think Craig Johnson from the League of Cities and Louis Jamboy from the Metropolitan Area Municipalities would also like to make a few comments at the end of my presentation. Hopefully they'll support me and say what a wonderful job I do, but if not, what the heck.
And which one are we looking at first?
The blue book here, called Infrastructure Financing Programs. And then behind the cover, you'll notice a a little diagram that kind of explains the Public Facilities Authority's physical structure. It really consists of six commissioners. There's eight staff, including myself, and we operate numerous programs. And in those boxes, our main program is the Clean Water State Revolving Fund, or in the statute, it's the Water Pollution Control Revolving Fund. And then the next largest program is on the right-hand side on the bottom, the Drinking Water Revolving Fund. Then we have several other programs, the Transportation Revolving Loan Fund, County Credit Enhancement Program, Meth Lab Cleanups, and then several small grant programs associated with wastewater programs up above the box of the Clean Water State Revolving Fund. And I will get into those in more detail during my presentation. But just about everything we do as Public Facilities Authority, we do in conjunction with other state agencies. We're kind of the bankers, or the we bring to the table what I call expertise in municipal finance and dealing with the in the bond market. And we rely on other agencies to provide the let us know what the priorities are, what needs to be addressed, do the technical reviews and environmental review work, things like that. So that's really our background, kind of what we do. We do get involved in some policy discussions occasionally because we do fund a lot of these projects, and when things don't make sense to us, we generally will speak up, and that does happen occasionally. The PFA, just kind of get into it briefly, we have statutory authority for $1.5 billion worth of revenue bonds. That has been increased over the years as we've needed to increase our capacity to sell bonds to make loans for various public infrastructure projects. Both our wastewater and our clean water or drinking water revolving loan funds are AAA rated by all three rating agencies. And we got our AAA rating prior to the state of Minnesota's getting their first AAA after they had lost it. We were actually the first state agency to sell revenue bonds with the federal Clean Water Act, leveraging the state revolving loan funds. I think we're also the very first state to pass legislation that set up the revolving loan fund, and I know at least four other states that copied Minnesota state statutes after trying to figure out how to do it for a year or two, and finally, before they avoided losing federal funds, just took our statutes and passed them, including our neighbors to the east, Wisconsin, in the state of New York, and a few other big ones like that. In the early years, when we sold bonds, it was strange because most pooled bond programs were centered around housing or projects where no one would put any money into it, and the credits were so weak they couldn't sell bonds on their own. The state revolving loan funds were a little bit different. All of a sudden, we had a huge federal influx of federal funds. State had to match it, and overall, state or city, municipal, GO bond credits backing those payments were fairly good credits. So none of the rating agencies really knew how to rate bonds associated with state revolving loan funds of this magnitude. Our approach after the first year was kind of shaking our heads. Is they really didn't know how to rate these bonds or what questions to ask. So the next year we went in, rather than negotiating rating, we negotiated rating criteria. So I think over a period of two or three years, not only the state of Minnesota, even though we were the first, I think all three rating agencies have set out and published rating criteria for state revolving loan funds. And based on those criteria that they've adopted, all of them are slightly different. But just about every state that leverages their state revolving loan fund program has a better rating than the state GO bonds, primarily because of the diversity of the pool, the cash or the equity that's in it from state and federal funds. Anyway, trying to get back to the programs really operate. We get federal funds, we get state matching funds, and we also sell our revenue bonds, and we take those assets. In the early years, we took federal dollars and established a debt service reserve fund. We set it at $200 million, and the interest earned off that fund help subsidize the loans, and then all the state match and future federal capitalization grants and our bond proceeds went to make low-interest loans to borrowers, and we could afford to reduce the interest rate anywhere from 1 to 4%. We have a minimum of 1% loans to communities, but it is a substantial savings. Historically, we've given cities up to 18 months interest-free period while they're under construction, get their user fees in place before debt service payments are due. And we've also reduced a lot of costs associated with issuance. I think the only thing require in most cases is a bond council opinion that the bonds are indeed sold in legitimately and are legal securities when we purchase them. Currently, we have $955 million worth of bonds outstanding. The total assets in are $1.7 billion, and that's in all the programs. The PFA administers numerous programs, as I mentioned, in conjunction with other state agencies. We strictly look at the financial component side of it. Our partners in crime, so to speak, do all the technical work and tend to set the priorities for funding. The administrative expense, as a general rule, when it comes to the Clean Water Program, we operate less than 0.3% as far as our costs. So about 0.3% has been the historic average of our administrative costs. When you throw in the cost, because we also pay the Pollution Control Agency for their technical services related to the reviews, and then on the drinking water side, you throw in the Department of Health, and all the technical help we get from them, and the program operating costs for all those programs still under 2%, which is a fairly good bang for the dollar. I think about 1.2 actually on the wastewater side. The PFA, and like I said, does generate fees from its loan activities, and that's where how we cover the administrative costs, and we enter into interagency agreements with three different agencies beginning in the fiscal year, Department of Trade and Economic Development, where we're housed, with Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health. Between DEED and PCA is pretty much centered around the operation of the programs. With the Department of Health and the Safe Drinking Water Act, there's also several compliance requirements to accept the federal money. Or what they call set-asides that the state has to do, including operator certification and training and technical assistance to small communities on the drinking water side. And those funds go through the Department of Health, source water protection. There's a little more funds there. On the next page, just kind of give you a little thing. We do have some legislative initiatives this year, nothing in the bonding area, but we do have some legislative initiatives. PFA was created in Chapter 446 was created in 1987, 20 years. So this is our 20th year anniversary. Chapter 446 has been amended every year since then, in one form or another. Programs deleted, programs added, bonding authority as time went on. We finally decided we needed some codification, cleanup, clarification. When we looked at it, we also, plus a bunch of new programs we had last year. So we decided it was a good time to go through that and clean it up and present it. I think it's House File 790, if I recall, was introduced, and Representative Frank Moe is carrying that on the House side.
And does that go to environment finance, or where does that?
It has been referred to environment policy, I believe. And I also think it will go through Tom Rukavina's committee, because it does incorporate some rule changes for MPCA. And I believe Chapter 446A, or Public Facilities Authority, is under Tom Rukavina's committee at present.
And if that passes, does it change any of what we're hearing today is a lot of your ranking? Does it change the work you've done there?
I'll go into that, okay. But yes, to some degree, it will, because it's going to take into account stormwater and the impact on the environment that stormwater has. I think the PCA's rules on the wastewater projects that have been revised over the last 3 years and been in effect since March of last year are in pretty good shape, but it's the like realization now that TMDLs are being done, total daily maximum load, studies are being done, impact stormwater is becoming more and more known. So we put a stormwater component in that statute to modify the rules, and we have that sunsetted in the year 2012, which at that time I think PCA will have rules in place that will better understand the impact that stormwater has on the environment and deal with accordingly. But just some highlights real quick on the statute modifications. It's going to define my role as executive director as being an employee of the authority, responsible for the staff, responsible for the debt issuance, and responsible for compliance with all the federal tax and security laws. Also clarifying the authority's role and responsibility in as far as the financial feasibility and eligibility recipients, things like that. We want a lot of the language is trying to clarify language. We had non-defined terms in places for eligible entities. We tried to define all those or make them defined terms. We had terms that were defined three different ways in the statute, so rather than having multiple definitions, we kind of either spelled them out or clarified those. So just a lot of cleanup. The program modification, which is going to change some of the programs, I'll mention that briefly because those will be bonding requests that you'll see from us next year. But the total daily maximum load grant program was passed 2 years ago in the bonding bill. It was a program pushed by the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities at the time, and it provides a 50% grant to address the wastewater treatment component that is designed to address a water impairment, a TMDL. So something cities have to do to address a TMDL study, they're eligible for a 50% grant. That program was based, or priority under that program was set based on when a TMDL was approved. And they were thinking more of like a city ammonia standard for like City of Moorhead would be a TMDL, so then that city plan would be approved. What we found out is TMDLs are covered watersheds. So the very first one adopted, the Lower Mississippi Fecal Coliform, had over 200 local units of government that are affected by that TMDL. So what happens is you have the number one priority based on the date EPA approved that TMDL. You have 200 eligible applicants, all number one priority. So very difficult to operate that program. Plus there was no cap on it, so kind of want to put a limit on it so we know what future capacity is. So we worked.
So how did that resolve? Just in
well, exactly in the statute, we're going to change it to follow the PCA's project priority list. So the environmental criteria currently in place, if it's a TMDL issue, it will be ranked on that list and go down the list as far as the money goes. And then the money will still apply to that, only the component that's required to address the standards imposed on the city by the TMDL study. So it's a slight change, but it's a way of still addressing the highest priority projects because it could be a very expensive program as TMDLs get accomplished throughout the state to try to continue that. And then also put a cap on it of $3 million. And that was agreed to it actually last year, but it was towards the end of session and it was a little too late to get it put in when the conference felt uncomfortable thinking it was too much of a policy change at that stage of the game. So, and then also just some minor clarifications on the application certification process because there's no rules for that program. Everything is based in statute. The phosphorus grant reduction program is the same way. That program was the priority was established and when a facility plan was approved, and it really is designed to address the phosphorus strategy that PCA adopted back in March of 2000. And We can go back and reimburse projects that have been forced to address phosphorus under this program since March of 2000. And that is a 75% grant for the phosphorus component of the treatment capacity. As far as new phosphorus grant applications go, we're seeking to change it, not from when a facility plan was approved, but again, go back to PCA's project priority list so we know when or the kind of the environmental priority. Facility plans we found very confusing. Cities that have actually done it, only half the cities that have done the phosphorus actually did a facility plan. The others just did plans and specs and did the improvements, and not all cities that need phosphorus need to go through the facility planning process to make those improvements. And again, just kind of clarifying, these are things we learned through the first application cycle that we did this summer, so just trying to make those programs more workable, more understandable. The Small Community Wastewater Treatment Program was created last year in the Clean Water Legacy Bill, along, as well as the Phosphorus Reduction Grant Program. And we ran the first cycle there. We received $1 million in the bonding bill last year for that program, and $100,000 of general fund money for technical assistance. We saw a lot of interest by communities that want that program. But the program was designed for communities that know what their solution to their problem is, so designed for construction activities. And then, so they'd have to identify what the solution is. And then the technical assistance component was really designed to make sure they had the managerial, technical, and financial capacity to operate and maintain the systems once they were built. And it was really designed to replace septics or do mound systems, kind of a low-tech solution to very small communities, trying to avoid getting them involved in big pipe or municipal-type solutions. So what we want to do with this program, what we're coming into, we requested money to be added to the base budget, $100,000 a year, to provide upfront technical assistance to these communities so they can figure out what the solution is. And in essence, to go out and hire an ISTS designer to go in and look and see if septic systems can be a viable solution, or community mound systems, things like that. And these are systems that are under PCA's permit limits. So you're talking very small, anywhere from, I think, the three that we're going to be working with. I think one has 16 houses and another one about 20. I'm not sure what the third one is. But so we're talking very small communities. The ones that we are working with have been working on the solution for a couple years because they've been identified as having straight pipes. It is a bunch of homes that have a septic tank and no drain field or anything. They're just kind of hooked up to a field tile. So as the septics fill up with slugs on the bottom and the grease on the top, it pretty much just raw sewage going right into drain tiles and going into creeks. And they've been identified in various studies. So anyway, we are asking for money there, and that program, the change in that program, we're seeking a $10,000 grant plus $500 per household or septic so they can do soil borings and site evaluations to see if septic system is a solution. Now, to answer your question, a little more detail that you had, Madam Chair, earlier about changing the priority system, Article 2 of that bill addresses, just adds another 20 points or maximum 20 points for stormwater projects, and it has to be a stormwater project that is identified as needed through a TMDL study, and the city also has to have kind of a comprehensive plan, or I guess to address it, and then points based on impervious surface, the impact, how much water can actually be absorbed in the ground before it's discharged. But I won't get into it a lot, but stormwater is becoming an issue that is known to cause a lot of problems, especially with turbidity and fecaliform, and as well as phosphorus, just washing away a lot of waste. Next, I'm going to get into the tab marked. It's kind of an overview of our programs and our statutory requests this year, our legislative requests this year. I'll get into the clean water programs next. the revolving loan fund is...
And I don't know if it's here. Is there any historic report to us how much we have generally done in terms of bonding in each of these areas?
Yes, I have all that information coming up on the next... Actually, real quick.
Okay.
Some historic stuff. And then way in the back of the book, I actually included a list of every loan we have outstanding for people that are interested. That's the very last pages. So the information's there. And I'll try to hit on most of that. But the water, Clean Water Revolving Fund literally does the majority of wastewater projects in the state of Minnesota. You take all the financing programs in place, all the other grant programs that we operate, and they probably account for less than 15% of the total public financing going into wastewater. So this by far is the largest program. And it's a low interest loan program, minimum 1%, and kind of based on the community's ability to pay, and how the rates are set, and the cost per household. To date, since 1989, we made our very first loan in June of 1989, the city of St. James. We made over 340 loans for $1.6 billion. Interest savings close to $500 million, $480 million. I think by the time the year's over with, we'll probably be hitting the $500 million. The current year is called IUP. It's an intended use plan. Every year we have to submit a document to EPA telling them how we intend to use the assets of that fund. We identified 63 different projects for a total project cost of $279 million that we gave the green light to go ahead, and if they got certified and did the project, that we had funded. Not all projects go, and our experience tells us about two-thirds do go, a third doesn't. So we anticipate roughly around $160 to $180 million by the end of the fiscal year. I think we've done close to $114 already. With spring bidding coming up. And then the remaining of them will be carried over into the next year. Funding priorities for this, we follow PCA's project priority list. We go down the list. Actually, we ask everybody on that list if they're ready, if they want funding and are willing to proceed. And we get that information every year in the summertime before July 1st. And then look at how far down that list we can go based on the number of requests we have and how many we really think are going to go versus how much we do. And it really is a decision the board makes every summer when they look at this request is how much, given the fund's capacity, how much are we willing to use in that, of that capacity to address the current needs in any given year. Historically, we get about $300 million worth of requests every year to proceed with construction. And
what was the number again?
$300 million, right around there every year is what we get in requests. And we obviously do less than that. But and I'll get into a little bit more about fund capacity, so you can kind of see that in a little bit. Try not to confuse people too much by doing it. PFA has also allocated out of the Clean Water Revolving Fund close to $80 million to the non-point source programs, so clean up feedlots, or feedlot runoff controls, septic tanks, riparian strips, conservation tillage equipment, things like that. And we do not run those programs. We've provided $48 million to the Department of Agriculture for the Agriculture Best Management Practices Loan Program. I think the legislature has appropriated additional funds to that program for that. With the water or the Pollution Control Agency, they have what's called a Clean Water Partnership Program. They've used federal 319 money to do diagnostic studies, very much like the TMDL program. And we provide them funds through the Revolving Loan Program, where they actually make loans to communities to implement measures to eliminate pollutants. And we provided that agency, or PCA, over $29 million to do that. And we provided actually $2 million to DEED for a non-point. The one program that's active is a tourism loan program, and that's generally the Mapa Resort. Any water-based business is eligible to receive funds that are in septics and upgrade septic tanks. And it was something that started out with the LCMR, actually, in providing a little seed money to see if the program would work. And their attempt was to keep the Mapa Resorts in business. They were being, kind of being forced out because of the high cost of compliance and the high value of the land that they could sell off individual homes or cabins. But it's been very successful in getting the septic systems upgraded in a lot of these smaller resorts, and again, relatively small resorts.
Representative Johnke has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To this section that you just described, explain to me why you're providing revolving loan funds to our departments. Why won't they? Are they lower interest? Is that why they're going over there, or are they? Why won't Ag and PCA and Deed and others just take regular bonding money and set it over there? Why is it coming through you and then to them? Why won't RFA just make their own request and we put the money over there? I'm missing something here.
Okay. Mr. Coleman.
I forget when this started, but it started during the Carlson administration after a couple of farmers were fined $50,000 each and the governor wanted to set up primarily because of discharge of manure into streams intentionally. But he wanted to address the problem, especially on the Minnesota River, issues with non-point pollution. At the time, the thought was most of the non-point pollution is coming from individuals. The Public Facilities Authority did not want to deal with it. The Department of Ag at the time thought about $10 million, if they could have a $10 million revolving fund pool, that would work. And we've offered to divide $10 million. I believe it was back in 1983 and 1984. No, later than that, 93, 94, because we had lots of money at the time because the whole southern part of the state was underwater with the floods and no wastewater construction was happening, and we were getting about $35 million a year, $37 million a year from the federal government for seed capital. So, in essence, we turned over $10 million to the Department of Ag and at the time $5 million to the Pollution Control Agency to do the non-point work. They lend that money out at 0% interest and allow the local lenders to charge up 3% service fee to cover their cost. And you're probably in a better position to ask Ag how they operate the program.
Well, Madam Chair, but again, I'm trying to get back to a real basic question. Not how it's used.
Well, the legislature did it, put it out.
But why I don't understand why you'd be taking PFA money. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are revolving loan programs, and I'll use Ag as the example because that's in our committee. I mean, RFA is there. We do have the revolving loan programs. But why wouldn't we just give... It's obviously there's a cost if there's a no interest, so I understand maybe you paying that cost to help out on those projects, but why would you give the entire bonding monies over there?
Yes.
Or any monies over there? Again, we bond for RFA. It most of those funds don't even count against our bonding limit. Yes. Because they are paid back. So why is it coming from you over there? I'm missing that.
Yeah. Actually, it was Madam Chair, Representative Johnke, it was real easy for the legislature to appropriate money from our fund at no cost to them at the time. And we were willing to do it because from an environmental standpoint, we definitely saw the need there. I think from a bang for the buck, you know, we looked at the municipal side where you can leverage it pretty substantially versus non-point where there's really not a lot of leverage there. You provide a dollar at 0% interest and you expect a dollar's worth of work. But we figured the pollutants being removed are probably equivalent, municipal waste being a little less.
And again, Madam Chair,
well, we provide the money because the legislature wanted to, and they passed the bill. Actually, setting a limit, I think, up to like 160 or 150 million that we could provide the Department of Ag and 75 million the Pollution Control Agency for this. In several years back, I requested that the agencies, because they weren't, in my opinion, getting reviewed by the legislature, that we would start providing funds based on matching the legislative request, so at least there would be some legislative oversight and review other than just the Public Facilities Authority annually when they're doing interagency agreements looking at reports and doing out money.
Representative Junkie, what I hear you asking is why is it done under this umbrella and not under this
umbrella? Madam Chair, if there's only a certain amount of clean water revolving funds available and we're looking, I mean, we've got a lot of cities and other projects that we need to get done, I'm just not understanding. PCA, it's a revolving loan fund, and it's basically a revenue bond at that point. I'm not understanding why we wouldn't just do that, and why would we take it away from this authority that needs to go elsewhere?
I think, Madam Chair, I think the slight difference between the Department of Ag and the Rural Finance Authority over there is when the state sells revenue bonds for them, the funds go back to pay it with the interest. We've literally provided them money at no interest, so they manage that pot of money. That way they can make loans to farmers literally at 0% if they want. If they can get a lender to do it at 0%. Most of them are 2 to 3% loans.
And I won't drag this out any further, but again, I think there's maybe a better mechanism. I understand the no interest part, and perhaps just giving the money over to make up that interest difference and not the entire pot of money would be a wiser way to do it. Allocate that money over to the department, which that I would understand. Let them do the bonding over there, and you would have more capacity over here then to do other things. I'll keep thinking.
Representative Genius.
Just for a context here, when you talk, Representative Junkie asks about capacity. This would be a good time for me to ask the question that I always ask and want to know the answer to is, if we were doing what is not on a list, but what you believe needs to be done, just what money would you need per year from the state to do how much that's outstanding and hasn't been done?
Mr. Coleman.
More than I've been getting. I mentioned earlier I get requests for about $300 million a year in municipal wastewater projects. And with inflation literally double digit the last couple of years, it's probably going to increase somewhat. I don't need $300 million to make $300 million worth of loans. I think if I can get if the federal government, it looks like they're going to start increasing rather than decreasing funding for the state revolving loan fund, and if the state continues to provide the matching funds, we can put a big dent in it. Will it be enough? No, but I can show you in the capacity model the impact of a higher level of funding that was provided last year, and we're going to continue to request higher level of funding than is the minimum required to build that capacity up. Roughly, you know, another $30 million a year on top of what we're getting could probably get us there as far as the leverage component.
Okay, but that's for what's on the list. And a lot of people don't apply because they know it's not worthwhile applying. But if we were to do like the Department of Transportation does and puts the need out there, and so we can have it, we can view the need. Okay, now we're viewing the need. Not how much money everybody, what you've leveraged, but what do you need in order to meet the real need that's out there?
Yeah. Well, the current.
In other words, do you have like a 10-year or 15-year plan? What's the unmet need?
Madam Chair, Representative Wadgenius, that's a very difficult question to answer, and there's a lot of issues involved. The current needs list has $1.9 million worth of needs on it, and that by far is not the complete picture. It's probably double that. You throw in all the clean water needs that we would deal with, that is the municipal side, and you throw in stormwater, I mean, that's going to be an increasing component as time goes on because of the impacts that we're learning about there. But still, you also have to look at, you know, the capacity right now. It would take time to ramp up the engineering capacity, construction bidding, things like that. So you're talking to, if you really wanted to address all the needs in more accelerated manner, it would still take time gradually to increase that. I think we could do more now. I mean, you look at the unemployment in the construction field. There's over 5,000, I've heard, unemployed construction workers, but there's some capacity there.
Any follow-up, Representative Reunius?
I still haven't heard the number. I've heard you do it before, and I want to hear you do it again.
Oh. it's hard for me to throw out a number.
Did I hear 1.9 billion?
I said there are 1.9 known needs on the list today.
Pardon me?
$1.9 billion. Almost $2 billion. We know there's more than that. And rough guess, we could probably say that's probably, we could double that if you want to look at what the needs are in the next 10, 15 years. Because that list has grown steadily. Even when we hit too close to $200 million a year, that list actually grew more than we funded. So it does grow.
But the question is how much money mm-hmm. we would need to bond each year over the years, and how long a period of time mm-hmm. is. That's just the forward planning thinking yeah. that the chair is asking about. How much would we need? Is it $70 million a year? Is it $100 million a year?
I would think close to 60, 70 and grow with inflation would probably be a number. And again, it would depend on how much goes in the revolving loan fund. It gets leveraged a lot, historically about 10 or 12 to 1 versus grants. You know, where's the gap in affordability? Because there are limits to what the local government people can charge their residents and still remain competitive, and limits on what they can charge, and have especially some of the small rural communities got a lot of retired people, what they can literally afford on a monthly basis. So all those things are hard for me to give you an exact number.
But 60 to 70 million seems reasonable as a projection.
Yeah. That's what I noticed. Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, Terry, you mentioned the match, and is there a percentage from the federal government that we're required to match?
Yes.
And can you tell me what that percentage is?
It's a 1-to-5 match. For every $5 we get from the federal government, we're required to provide a $1 match.
And
last year I asked for a 1-to-1 match. The governor agreed because the needs were growing a lot faster than we could handle. And I hope to continue to seek that level of funding.
So, Madam Chair and Mr. Coleman, what you're saying is that the federal government has given us so much money. In the past, we've always made sure that we've had the local match for that. But you're asking us to fund more than what the federal government matches. Is that what I hear you're saying?
Correct. That's last year in the bonding bill, we request match at the time. We're actually going to end up getting a little more than that from the federal government.
So, Madam Chair, I'm going to pursue a little bit. So if we gave you $60 million, that would be, but the federal government would only give you, $20 million? Is that correct?
Do we have an average for the federal government?
Yes. Right now, this year we're looking at 19. Last year we were looking at about 16.5. President Bush's budget wasn't very generous in the environmental area. We used to get around 35, 37. Gradually got cut back to about 1.3 million, where it was stable for several years. Nationally, allocation 1.3 billion. We got about 24 million a year out of that. And then the last 3 years dipped down to 14 million. So we've taken a pretty sizable cut in federal funds in the last 4 years.
Wow, I'm just bringing this up to point out the fact that our goal always in the past was to make sure we get all the federal money and make that match. Obviously, we've had to do more than that or even have some kind of a program in existence, which is very disturbing.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Mr. Kuma now, kind of following up on Representative Wagenius and Representative Solberg's question. We spent a lot of time 2 years ago trying to figure out a way to fund Clean Water Legacy, and the portion for wastewater treatment was part of that. And mm-hmm. one of the ideas we batted around was looking at trying to capture a dedicated revenue stream statutorily that could go to the PFA, that perhaps whenever there's a land transaction, that maybe $5 would be collected. There's about 1 million land transactions a year, $5 million. What if we had, if we gave that to you into the Clean Water Revolving Fund, $5 million a year from a, mm-hmm. that would fluctuate, what would you be able to do with that?
Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, historically we leverage our funds about 3 to 4 to 1, somewhere in that neighborhood. So $5 million a year probably would translate into $20 to $25 million in construction work. If I could jump ahead a little bit, I'll just identify some pages, but I want to get to a graph that will answer that question a little better.
We
one of the
have
points.
Murphy and Mahoney. Do you want to get to this before he...
Madam Chair, I have a question of Mr. Coleman based on what Representative Wagenius said.
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Coleman, I think I heard her say that some entities don't apply because they don't have a chance. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that?
Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, there's lots of reasons why people don't apply. Some of them, if they know they're just going to be ranked real low, because we do have a cutoff, they don't bother getting on the list. I have, in early years, I used to call, because I knew a lot of city administrators in my previous life, I used to call them up and ask why didn't they use our program when I'd see them selling bonds. And they would usually sheepishly say, well, we didn't want to deal with state government, and we'd rather pay higher debt service. So there's all kinds of reasons why people don't get on the list. I mean, sometimes it's, you know, the engineers, there are some firms that really do not like working with state or federal agencies. They'll do everything they can to get the communities to do it on their own. Financial advisors are the same way. Their jobs are based on fees, so if they can get cities to go to the private market and sell debt, that works. So, I mean, we don't do everything, but we try. But there are those, because, you know, there is cutoffs, relatively well known. And drinking water, we don't go below 10 very often, so projects that rank at, you know, 5 or 7 points tend to go on their own. And wastewater, you know, because of the demand is getting way beyond when they rank fairly low on the list, and they still want to do it, they generally go on their own or they won't bother. But to be able to get yourself scored relatively easy, the system's all up on the website, at PCA's website, and most of the communities can figure out their score relatively easily. And some of them won't get on that list because they don't really want to raise attention. If they can squeak by without raising red flags to the regulatory agency, they will do that as well.
And Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, that was one of the questions. Do they just let it go then, or do they try to solve the problem themselves? But mm-hmm. my experience with your agency has found that even though maybe they were afraid to apply or they didn't think they had a chance, but working with your agency, you assisted them to how to think mm-hmm. so that their score could be raised.
Right.
Because they didn't have, without the assistance from your agency or without the funding from your agency, they wouldn't have a chance of correcting the problem.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, not too many communities that really want to do something have not done something. We've been able to work with them one way or another, and if we couldn't do it, usually found someone else that could help or found techniques or methods that they can solve their problems by other means, but we do our best.
Yes.
Try to help.
Representative Mahoney.
I can answer my question anytime if you wanted to answer Representative Hansen's question.
Okay.
yeah. if you want to yeah. move ahead a couple
if I just
of weeks. We'll keep you on the list now.
Turn the page, and you'll have a history of all the federal funds and state match funds. But then you go into the chart or the graph, and last year I did this as part, did a different graph as part of the Clean Water Legacy, assuming the PFA would get roughly about $20 million a year in the water revolving fund out of those funds, and the $20 million a year, I think we calculated, I forget how many years we went out, but like 20 years, literally brought those lines up to close to $150 million annually. But currently right now, the black line, if we don't receive another penny from the state or federal government, the fund has the capacity to do about $65 million a year in perpetuity. I mean, with the loan repayments coming back in. With the funds we received last year, the one-to-one match, we bumped that up to about another $12 million. That's $32 million plus the federal cap grants we were getting because of that makes that difference. And we're still doing roughly about $160 million. If we can continue to get that one-to-one match, which was in the governor's long-term projection in his binding proposal last year, $32 million for the next two bienniums, show you the impact. If we continue to fund projects at the $160 million, we would have an ongoing long-term capacity of $89 million. So the more equity we get in there, you know, the more projects we can do in a long time. Can we move that line up and down? Yes, we can. By either funding more projects this year makes that line move down slightly, or if we do less, that line can go up slightly. So, but it, from a projection standpoint, you know, what's the capacity or how much dry powder are we going to keep for the future versus the needs today is kind of how we look at it. It's kind of decisions the board looks at every year when they look at the intended use plan and how far down the list they want to go, because the needs grow, you know, want to do as much as we can, but we still want to hold some capacity out there in the future. So could we do $300 million a year next year, because that's the request? Yes, we can, but then that long-term capacity to address the projects is going to shrink. So, does that help a little bit?
Yep, Pen Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kuhlman, I think I sat through 4 or 5 days of sewer and water requests a year or two, or God, it seems a lifetime ago. Thank you. And one of the questions I asked then, and I started to ask pretty regularly of these towns that were coming in, is what were your sewer rates?
Mm-hmm.
And there was a number of conversations that were held with me privately about that particular question, so I'll rephrase it. Are these towns that come to you paying in proportion to what it actually costs to treat their sewers, treat their water, and treat the sewage, how close are they to the true cost of, you know, in their water bill every month or their sewer bill every month? That's my first question. And I don't know if you can answer that.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, I think I can. We review part of our loan portfolio management audits from about half the municipalities in the state every year, to make sure they maintain their revenues sufficient to cover the operation maintenance costs and debt service, part of our obligation to maintain our AAA bond rating. And also we review historicals of every project we do fund, we go back 3 years, 5 years, you know, see the trends in their financials. And I would say it's a mixed bag. Some cities are very well managed out there and are forward thinking, and usually larger ones that do these projects or components on a more frequent basis, that is, they'll probably do a component of their treatment plan every 4 or 5 years. You'll see them have fairly significant rates in the $40-$50 range, because they're covering their true operation maintenance costs, they're covering debt service. They've got a debt service management plan or capital improvement program. and they also know what they needs to be done in 4 years and 10 years, and are at least make sure they got the money so they can, you know, they can get started. And then there's also a lot of communities that we've seen not change their rates for 10, 20 years. There was a good number of those, I think it was last year, or maybe was it 4 years ago, I think we had about 30 or 40, I forget when it was, but a good number of them had great sob stories, and when you look at them, I mean, they had $12 sewer rates, and they hadn't changed their rates in 20 years, and the useful life of their treatment plant was expired 20 years ago. And as much as you want to help them and feel sorry for them, you also don't. And then you also have communities that have done that work every year. And Ascoff is one of my favorite communities, and I got funded last year $3.5 million to relocate their pond system. But if you look at their FF City, I mean, it's one of the lowest income communities in the state, relatively small, and they've done major capital improvement projects through a combination of loans and grants almost every other year, because they realized about 18, 19 years ago that everything was failing, so they just started doing bits and pieces as they could afford to do it, and they have pretty significant water and sewer charges. I think as the mayor last year testified, he was paying like single and has a dog, and he pays $65 a month for sewer and like 40 or something like that for drinking water. And is kind of asking for help because they needed help. But that town, you know, and we worked with them over the years, but the only thing they thought they had left was some riprap around the ponds and to clean them out, and it'd be good for another 20 to 30 years. And they found out that it was on ponds was on top of some harsh sandstone and literally leaking, and it was showing up in wells downstream, and they were ordered to move. And not only were they ordered to move, but because of the Annandale Maple Lake court case, they were not allowed to discharge. So it kind of changed their... They could have built a new pond system for about $3.5 million, but then when you throw a no discharge in it and buy land and land apply, that was another million. So it became a very expensive project. That town I felt sorry for it because I thought they were well-managed. They took the thing in stride. They knew what they needed to do. And they've been going at it in just circumstances beyond their control. But you're right, and it's frustrating with us sometimes, too, because they're the ones that end up tending to be needing a little more subsidy than you'd normally like to give them because they really haven't done a lot. It doesn't mean they don't pay the penalty. If you, most communities that we do, they're eligible for the WIF program, and they haven't gotten into some of the wastewater projects. Yeah, I mean, you're talking $50, $65 a month sewer range, and we've got several now pushing $100 a month just for wastewater. So there's a price to pay for doing that, but it still happens. I would say municipalities are getting better and better. Of course, there's not that many left. Like I said, we've already funded almost half the non-metro cities in the state or more than half. So once they're...
The other part to my question, because of the nature of my part-time, my other job, mm-hmm. I talk to a number of people that do sewer and water companies, and they do them around the nation. And one of the things that I've heard from one of them that's done about six of these big 25,000 person towns is their meters were so old that if they used 100 gallons of water in a day, they were really only metering at about 60 or 65 gallons of water. Is that happening in this state, or have you heard of any of that happening in this state?
Madam Chair, real briefly,
Mr. Coleman, it
does happen, and meters are generally required when they function at a lower level. So if they're not maintained, and trust me, in Minnesota Rural Water visits every small town, population under 10,000 every year. That's one of the things they do, is make sure the operators have a good meter maintenance program. So they always have meters on hand, and they literally will rotate the meters, like every 10, 15 years, will go in and replace them, overhaul them, and go back. But meters are designed by default to reduce the readings rather than increase the ratings, so the city's not liable for misreading meters.
Representative Finkelstad, and then we're going to have to ask you to wrap up quickly.
Okay.
Oh, okay. So just, yes, if you could hit the highlights of the rest of the report.
Okay. Well, as long as it's Capital Investment Committee, I'll do the highlights. I mentioned the state matching funds already that I'll be requesting probably more one-to-one match, $32 million again, so because the need for that program exists. And some of the other programs, real briefly, I need Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program, or WIF, is a term that's been used up here at the Capitol more than probably any other related to wastewater. We'll continue to ask money for that. It's used to match the USDA Rural Development Loan Grant Program. We match their grants 50-50, lets them spread their money out a little bit better, reduces our administrative costs by letting them do the work. And it also usually captures a little additional federal dollars. They're able to tap the national pools. And we also, for high-cost projects that use our loan program, we provide 0% loans until our loan's paid off, and then they can pay the same annual rate as they pay on the revolving loan fund until the WIP is paid off. So it spreads that, their loans out as well. So we'll continue to ask for that program. And a report is due to the chairman of the committee and the Finance Committee and Capital Investment Committee on February 1st of the bonding year, so we'll get those reports here. The total daily maximum load grant program, again, that was funded at $7 million. We'll continue to look at that, and most likely we'll be submitting a request next year for funding for that program as well. Same with the phosphorus grant program. The small community as well. Again, if we can get the base budget passed this year, do the technical assistance, we'll be building a pipeline of projects for that program as well. Not a lot of money, but $1 million, $2 million a year. Start cleaning some of those up. On the next tab, you'll see our funding list in green. And this year's combination of the old and new. Which the gray shaded ones are ones we funded this year, and they're scattered all over because a lot of them are on last year's priority list under PCA's old rules, and a lot of them didn't bother getting re-ranked under the new rules, so you'll see a lot of one-point projects that we funded. And I should mention, Madam Chair, somewhere along this legislative session, there will be a couple projects that are on PCA's old project priority list that was changed back in March. And last year during the legislative session, you grandfathered those projects that had 400 points or more on the old list, gave them a year to get certified and approved. But because Annandale Maple Lake court case hasn't been resolved yet, we still have some projects that aren't sure what they need to do, and they're not going to rank high enough on the new list, and we'd like to grandfather some of them over because they spent too much money to be left off the list. So we're going to wait a month or two and see what happens, and the court case is settled. We can still get them done. If not, I might be asking someone to plug a paragraph in somewhere for me. So just to let members know, it is an issue.
A few more minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. I'll be very happy to plug it in and it'll make a lake whenever you want.
Yeah.
Okay. That's one of them.
Mr. Coleman.
And then the white sheet is alphabetical, a listing of all the projects that have trouble finding them. And then some of the set-aside programs real quick. The total daily maximum load, we ran a funding cycle with the $7 million we received the last 2 years this summer. You'll see how far that got. We actually got about almost $16 million with a request for that $7 million. The phosphorus reduction grant program, we received $2.3 million to be able to do about five, maybe six projects. That program, they literally do have to get certified and bid their project before May 1st, or we go down. So we do have some of the projects lower on that list that have actually been bid. So the ones up on top, if they don't get their work done by May 1st, we will get to some of the lower ones that have actually started already and have been certified. And then on the back page is a continuation. So you'll see the And that line there is when I mentioned we can go back and reimburse projects. The ones that have actually started before the bill was passed are the before ones on the bottom. And by law, if there's any money left over, that, you know, we can go down and do the reimbursement. The problem with that is you can't use state GO bond proceeds to do that because, in essence, the project's been done. So what you're doing is really refinancing their debt. So that require general fund money, in essence, or some other source to actually do that. I do want to touch on the drinking water program real quick. If I need to wrap up quickly, I'll just say we'll be in for state match requests there. We'll be requesting our 1-5 match. I think we have sufficient funds, and the federal government hasn't been cutting that. They've actually been increasing it a little bit to do the high-priority needs in that program. But that is a program we'll be coming in for. And then you'll notice we got a breakdown by year, what we've done, and by region of the state, what the rates are, and again, the history of the state match funds and future projections of the state match. And then we have the needs list there, very similar to the wastewater one. And I won't get into the other programs or our portfolio. I'll kind of give you a little history of all the projects we've done, some pie charts and allocation of funds. You know, the state's in it for very little money overall historically, as far as the total dollars that go in for construction until we start asking for one-to-one match. That's a kind of a quick summary. I know a couple of people wanted to say a few words
time. But we'll have the League of Minnesota Cities and the Association of Metropolitan Cities to...
Can I have just one quick thought while they're coming down? Mr. Coleman, there are quite a few small cities around. The Tamaracks, the Palisades, the Comfreys of the world where they're...
Corrective actions
are needed because of some engineering problems. Do you have a list of those, and are you going to need some additional bonding authority this legislative session on an emergency basis to be able to correct those?
Mr. Chair, Representative Silberg, I do have a list, and I can give it to you. We've only done like 3 of the 13 communities. A lot of them are still doing their corrective action plans. I don't want to get into a long history of this, but you're familiar with what happened. I think we can wait until next year to find out where the gap is. I know a couple in your region are going to need more money, but do I have it on hand already to move over? Because we're not sure how much it's going to cost to correct all of them.
Thank you.
Have a better picture next year.
Thank you.
So, yes, please come forward, Mr. Johnson, if you would like to begin and identify yourself for the record, and we'll have both of you drive to the table.
Thank
you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'm pleased to be able to add a little bit on to the Public Facility Authority description of what they do, because it really is very, very vital work that they do to help our cities meet their requirements, their obligations for environmental protection and both wastewater and drinking water. I'm going to talk primarily about our wastewater and stormwater issues, and I'm only going to take a few minutes to do it because I know you've got some other business that you need to attend to, and I'm up here all the time. You can ask me questions whenever you like. So a question came up earlier about the longer-term need for wastewater funding from Representative Wagenius and others. The best source we have for that right now is that every other year, the Pollution Control Agency asks communities statewide, in fact requires, they are required to reply to a future wastewater infrastructure funding needs survey called the WINS report, and it looks at 5 and 10 years out all projections from every community, whether they actually intend to go forward or whether they don't know if they're going to, but they would like to. So it gets a little more into some of the speculative things that Representative Wagenius was referring to. The current identified 10-year need in the 2006 report was $3.2 billion. That is the amount of funding that cities projected that they needed. That does not include any new requirements that cities may be needing to do because of a completed TMDL. There may be communities that suddenly find out they have to do significant improvements to their facility that they were not expecting to do. And it does not include any of the funding needs for stormwater. As an example, under these new environmental requirements that are coming down to cities through the Federal Clean Water Act being implemented finally in Minnesota. The Minnesota River Valley, as an example, had a phosphorus nutrient load problem. All cities in the Minnesota River Valley that already had a federal stormwater permit requirement are now going to have to demonstrate that they have reduced their stormwater discharge of nutrients by 30%. Well, that cost is going to show up somewhere. We don't know how exactly they're going to cover that, but they have to do it. Communities that do not have a stormwater permit, so the smaller communities in the Minnesota River, have to demonstrate that they are reducing theirs by 20%. Now, they don't have a permit, but they still need to be showing that they are making progress towards doing that. And obviously, in a lot of these smaller communities that are pretty much built out and are not growing, that's going to be almost entirely having to be done with public infrastructure and public funding. There's not a new developer that's going to come in and put in a bunch of retention ponds, and there isn't land to put them on if they wanted to. So it'll be a pretty challenging situation. I'm sure we'll be talking about that over the next 5 years quite a bit. The one step that's being taken to address that is that the Pollution Control Agency this year, when they send out their survey, will be including a section on the wastewater survey for stormwater survey, so that they're going to start asking communities what stormwater needs are you anticipating over the next 5 and 10 years, as well as what wastewater ones. And that is, so that you're clear, it's a statutorily required report. Cities are actually required to respond to that survey. Several of the programs that were referenced here are particularly key. I would point out that I think the Public Facilities Authority is one of the most trusted places my cities go to when they need resources. I think there are some reasons that cities hesitate to go in, as Representative Murphy was asking earlier. I think one is they frequently don't go in if they expect they're going to rank low. They don't want to be told, okay, you can sit here for 20 years and see if you get your funding or not. They would rather either just not worry about it, not have that project sitting there, not knowing when it's going to start, not pay those engineering costs up front when they don't know if they're going to get the funding anyway. But I think also most of those smaller communities want grants. And if they don't think they're going to get that, they don't bother applying at all, because they don't realistically have or consider themselves to have the capacity to pay off a large loan for that kind of a project. So if they don't think they're going to be eligible for a grant, they just let the system wait until they maybe have a crisis that they have to deal with. Don't know what's clicking on you. Sorry, folks. There are three programs in here that were created during the discussions of the Clean Water Legacy Act last year. I think I want to spend my last couple minutes highlighting those, because they're very important for our cities. One is the TMDL Grants Program. That program, as you saw in toward the back of the wastewater project list, it's on the brownish colored piece of paper, it had $7 million that were put into it over two bonding bills. And you can see that there were $16 million worth of requests that were eligible for funding from that fund. Very heavy demand. These are communities that are having to do upgrades to deal with requirements of a completed federal cleanup plan for a polluted water. And you can also see that the cities, essentially, it's a 50% program. So the cities were putting in another $16, $17 million on top of that of their own money to pay for the cost of those projects. That program, the $7 million, has been allocated. If we do not have some additional revenue go into it this year, if there is any sort of bonding done, it will sit with no money available for any cities. Even if they do want to move forward, they won't be able to until we go through another bonding bill in the future. So I would suggest, Madam Chair and members, that if there is any sort of small bonding bill moving forward, that putting even a couple of $1 million in these funds does allow cities to at least continue to move forward on building projects. Right now, because of the Annandale-Maple Lake lawsuit that says that we cannot build new wastewater treatment discharges in this state until a TMDL is done that allows it, adding additional treatment to a plant is about the only way a lot of these can go forward, and that can be rather expensive. The TMDL grants program and the phosphorus grants program are the way they can do that right now. The other benefit of the TMDL grants program is it funds stormwater projects also, which have had a very hard time being funded in the past, and Louie's going to cover stormwater more. The phosphorus grants, I would add one point on that Mr. Kuhlman ended with, and that is that we had some funding, $2.3 million, that has already been allocated to pay for cities that need to add phosphorus treatment to their plant to be able to move forward. We have many communities that have had to spend significant money on, put their own dime in, to get phosphorus treatment put on their facilities over the past 5 years, and that is going to take a different pot of money. The bonding money that was done for that, in hindsight, was not going to be adequate because we can't use GO bond money to cover debt service on a project that's already been built. So we are going to have to look for some general fund sources or other sources of revenue to cover some of those needs. But I think it's very important, even just as a fairness issue, that the communities that have already made an investment in doing this shouldn't be penalized when new communities are going to get some help, hopefully, to deal with those costs.
And from the Association of Metropolitan Cities, the Executive Director, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. My name is Louis Jamboy. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. We have 86 members in the 7-county metro area that include the core cities, fully developed area, the developing area of the Twin Cities, and the urban fringe in all 7 counties. So we're fairly broadly based in that regard. I'll go as fast as I can. Again, thanks for having me here today. I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee, and I want to make just 3 brief points if I can. First, that Metro Cities endorses the administration initiative. It's in the first couple of pages of Terry Coleman's book to amend Chapter 116.182 to add sufficient points to the project priority list to rank critical storm sewer projects on an equal footing or relatively equal footing with wastewater treatment projects. That's a critical issue in the metropolitan area as the Twin Cities area grows and particularly redevelops. You've heard a lot about TMDLs and mostly with respect to wastewater treatment plants, but the truth of the matter is when a receiving water receives a TMDL value, that impairment can't increase from any source, be it wastewater treatment or from stormwater. And wastewater treatment is relatively easy to deal with in that regard, in that there's one entry point into the plant and there's one outfall outside the plant from which impairments can be measured into receiving waters. But stormwater is a much, much different game. There are hundreds of entry points into stormwater systems, and there are hundreds of entry points from those stormwater systems into receiving waters. And as the area develops and redevelops, permits for that kind of development will be measured against how those developments and redevelopments affect impairments in those receiving waters. There's no question that in any developed area, and the Twin Cities area is the biggest one in the state, that in any developed area, if we're doing development or redevelopment projects, that the cost of stormwater management is going to increase dramatically. And as a result, we believe the project priority list process should be amended to address expensive and critical stormwater needs. The PCA and the PFA have worked on that issue with us, and we endorse the work that they've been doing. Second, Metro Cities endorses the administration initiative to run the TMDL grants through the project priority list process. Simply put, we think the utilization of existing and well-established and credible human and organizational infrastructure and processes and procedures is the way to run a new grant source to assure that we wind up with better program outreach and better project selection and project administration. And finally, we'd like to raise the issue of inflow and infiltration in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, something that is often called I&I. If you look at Terry's book under the wastewater project list, the back page, right in front of the brown page, there's a number that suggests that we have a $1.9 billion wastewater treatment need in the state that's documented. If you notice, there are a few II projects on that list. None of those apply to the Twin Cities metropolitan area. The Met Council, however, has put together an II surcharge program to charge Twin Cities area cities to the tune of about $19.4 million two-thirds of that charge would be accrued to the cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis if the Met Council proceeded with that charge. Now, that charge is not based on actual cost of construction to remove I&I. It's based on the additional cost to treat additional wastewater that comes in as a result of peak storm events.
And so we did have a bit of a discussion the other day with the Minnesota Zoo, who brought the issue before us through the city of Eagan. So the committee has heard a bit about that, and clearly you're saying to us we're going to hear more.
You will hear more, Madam Chair, and I think that's my cue to stop. So I will do that. I'll add just one more thing. Terry Coleman mentioned that he hoped that that Metro Cities and the League of Minnesota Cities would tell you that he and his merry band do a wonderful job at the PFA. So I'm here to tell you that Terry Coleman and his merry band do a wonderful job at the PFA.
We have all experienced that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're so sorry to the city of Blooming Prairie. We have Mayor Peterson, city of Blooming Prairie, and Mike Jones, the Blooming Prairie City Administrator, and the representative who represents them, Representative Fritz, coming forward. I thought it would be helpful, since we have now just had a huge education, to in fact have one community come to the table and talk about what it means for them. And so we are grateful for your being willing to come and, in a sense, personify for us. I mean, you are real people in a real town, and telling the story that we have heard in generalities right now, and we welcome you. And just to get this issue before us, Representative Fritz, I'll move House File 109. That issue is before us for you to speak to.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to the committee members today. And I'm honored to be sitting next to the Honorable H. Peterson, the mayor of Blooming Prairie. Blooming Prairie is the end of my district, District 26B. And Blooming Prairie is the home of Blossoms. And the Mayor H. Peterson and Mike Jones, the city administrator, we've been working together. We've submitted a bill last year, and we have the House File 109 again this year. And they can do a much better job telling you about the needs in Blooming Prairie. And I will turn it over to Mayor Peterson.
Welcome.
Thank you, Representative Fritz. Madam Chairman and committee, I thank you for hanging in there with us for a few extra minutes today. We'll try and keep this within our time limits. It says here that it's about Blooming Prairie street and sewer improvements, but really it's all about what's under the streets. The streets are a secondary issue. I mean, it's because this stuff is under the streets are included. To give you most of the facts of our story, I'd like to turn it over to our administrator, Mike Jones, who knows a whole lot more about the topic than I do.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please identify yourself.
Michael Jones, I'm City Administrator of Blooming Prairie, Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee to listen to my plead, I guess. Back in September of 04, we realized the September 11th of the New York City, but we received it in Blooming Prairie in the form of 12 inches of rain in a matter of 8 hours. Blooming Prairie was inundated and actually was included in the FEMA, the Presidential Declaration of Disaster because of the flooding. But what makes our situation unique is the fact that we did not get flooded. We're a community that doesn't have a river close to us. We don't have a lake close to us. We don't even have a pond close to us. We're just a community that's setting out in a flat part of our agricultural society. And as the town has grown, it started off with an infrastructure that was designed in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and have grown to the west into the flood plains, and we just don't have the infrastructure to handle the type of flooding that we're seeing now on an annual basis, and then to the point that that flood was really the straw that broke the camel's back. The city of Blooming Prairie did start preparing for this type of disaster. Back in 1998, they did do a comprehensive plan on what it was going to take to start solving our storm sewer problems. With that plan, they did do a southwest truck line and put in a large regional retention pond That actually saved a lot of houses in the southwest area of our community. We also then, after the flooding, brought in our engineers again and did a new updated comprehensive plan of the overall flood plan of the whole community. We then took that comprehensive plan and divided it into priorities. Priority number one is really the issue that we're here, is what we call our Third Street Corridor. That street right now consists of the piping system going from one end to our town to the other of only 15-inch pipe. The 15-inch pipe is trying to drain a 204-acre drainage area, which also includes 33 acres of farmland, which has to find its way through our system to get to the other side of town to find the river, which is a mile and a half away. So our system is overtaxed to its max every time we have an inch of rain. It isn't about 12 inches. It isn't about 4 inches. Just about an inch of rain now brings damage to property in the community. Also, that we have on the horizon coming up here real soon is a bond referendum for our school district. If we do pass our bond referendum, part of the that school is sitting on the west side of town. All the water that will have to come off the new facilities, the new parking lot, are going to have to go through our system. This northwest corridor that we're presenting here would be part of that corridor that will be used to drain that system of the school. So we are going to be mandated to provide them a corridor to remove their water from their facility once it's constructed. So we have to look into the future and see there's a lot of problems that have to be taken care of. And we really don't have a lot of time to put this project off. Now, the city of Blooming Prairie, as I mentioned earlier, has already started spending some funds to alleviate some of these problems. Prior to our flooding in 2004, we'd already spent almost $765,000 in different projects to eliminate either sanitary sewer inflow and or handling stormwater inflow. Since this time, we've now spent a lot of money with engineering. We've also acquired land to locate a retention pond on the northwest of edge of town. We are currently actually starting a project in the middle corridor. We have a manufacturer that's going to be building, actually has built a new facility, and we are going to put in some new stormwater to a tune of about $200,000 to $250,000 into that project to help convey the water away from his property. And on top of that, we did a investment in our community last year. We took the gamble that we would get a D grant to help pay for our infrastructure and our industrial park. We were denied the grant, but we still continued with the project. So we invested about $500,000 in that project, which just throws us off again off the radar screen of the ability to bring this type of project in on board, because we've just spent so much money in a project that now we're going to have to wait a few years for our bonding to get in a way that we can handle that funding. Again, we're not on the floodplain, so we're not even on, if you were to look at Blooming Prairie in a flood map, we're not even on the floodplain because we're so far away from any water. And I guess
about it.
We've done a lot of things, and we're going to continue to do a lot, but we really need some assistance. We're dealing with a town that is growing. We're a community that is growing, and we just can't continue to tax our taxpayers to bring the infrastructure that's needed to continue to grow, especially in the Northwest Corridor, because that's not where we're growing. We're growing in the Southwest Corridor, which we have already invested our funds. But with the school coming on board and how that's going to affect our system, this quarter becomes a real number one priority for our community.
Representative Lanning has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jones, you've indicated that you've been doing some things to try and correct an inflow problem. To what extent have you been able to separate your sanitary and storm sewer facilities? To what extent do you still have them combined so that your sanitary is having to handle stormwater? And also, have you addressed the problem that so many homes have some pumps that are taking stormwater, rainwater, and directing it into the sanitary? Have you been able to make some progress in correcting that?
Actually, Blooming Prairie has been very aggressive on that field. Blooming Prairie and put in our ordinance prior to my time there on the city administrator, but I would say 1998, which requires all homes in our community to have a sump pump inspection. We've then also put in ordinance that every house that's being sold in Blooming Prairie is required to have their sanitary sewer line inspected with a camera so that we can ensure there's no illegal hookups and that their private sewer line are in proper operating condition. In 2006, we did reline 8 blocks of our sanitary sewer, which were our biggest inflow contributors to the community. And that little project did enough that when we had a rain last summer in 06 of approximately 2 inches in a very short period of time, the lift station that is connected to the lines that were traditionally we would have bypassed, even with that small of a rain, was not required to bypass and didn't even really have to work overtime. We have spent the time to bring engineers. We've smoke tested all of our sanitary lines. We have disconnects and some storm sewers that were connected to our line. And then part of this Northwest project that's really another thing other than just the storm sewer is when that system was put in, the storm sewer and the sanitary sewer all operate at the same level. So every personal service goes through our storm sewer. And we have slowly tore up the street and replaced that situation. But we have big sewer mains that actually go right through the storm sewer. And we did discover one of them was one of our contributors to our inflow and was able to take care of that through our inspection system.
Further, Representative Lanning?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad to hear of the things that you've done. And obviously, local communities have got the first and foremost their own responsibility for addressing the inflow problem. And the problems that you've identified are common throughout the state. And I hope you can appreciate that the state is not in a position to help all of the communities who face this. I think what we have to judge is your circumstance so unique that it justifies that there would be a special state appropriation to help address the issue, and that's a judgment we're going to have to make.
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, I was looking at the letter that you provided and just kind of wondering how the numbers come together. You said that in the letter that the plan required or suggested $4 million and you're requesting $1.5 million, and you threw out some numbers that of things that have already been spent. So what remains for the local to provide then relative to the $4 million, or did that number change?
Mr. Jones.
Yes, the $4 million actually has been, that was involved in a comprehensive plan that we did of our storm sewer in 2005. And from there, we pulled off the $1.5 million for that north corridor. The $4 million includes all of the stormwater improvements that are needed throughout the whole community, all of the different drain fields, not just this one drain field, which is dealing with 200 acres. If we were able to receive some funding, the city's commitment is this $1.5 million will only put that corridor in. We still have to put the infrastructure in and all the laterals to bring them up to date. We've got 12-inch laterals, and one of them is actually the one that roads all the way up to the school parking lot. And all that's doing now is supercharging our storm sewer and bubbling water up at all of intersections. So we will need to upgrade. That's kind of our commitment to this project.
So just in terms of the ballpark, then the city is going to incur, it looks like, on the base of a $2.5 million expense for the balance of the city, and then that corridor is the $1.5 million. Okay.
Right.
I was just trying to rectify the $4 million here, what was in the bill. So thank you.
Well, we thank Representative Fritz.
Well, I just wanted to add that this is a proactive, small, greater outer state Minnesota city that is trying to survive and actually is surviving and meeting the needs of a group of people. And we talk about, you know, we all don't want to move up here and live up here and crowd you out. So I do applaud the efforts that the city has has given this project, and
some
and
of that development has to happen out there.
It has to happen out there as well. So thank
well,
you
we
again.
Thank you very much for being willing to come and tell your story as sort of demonstration of the issue, the larger issue we've been talking about today, and we'll be laying this bill over for future consideration. Again, thank you for coming, and if there's no further discussion, meeting is adjourned.
All right, thank you.